I didn't know. When I started thinking about what kind of a non-residential, I do a lot of non-residentials because I believe that for urban practitioners, we don't really always have the ability, the financial resources, or even this the capacity to manage a long retreat. So oftentimes, I found myself when I was practicing law and I was on the trial team, the only time I could ever really get any extended practice time was on the weekends. I didn't have the ability to just take off for a week. Even if I had the money to do it, I didn't have the time to take off work and just go. So what became my extended practice was weekend non-residentials. And Seattle Insight used to offer about 7 of them a year, and I would do every one just so I could spend this time to sit quietly. So every year, I do a non-residential, and I do it everywhere, all over the country. And I pick a subject that I feel like is something that's alive in the Dhamma, and I practice with that subject all year. I practice with it, I practice with it, I try to understand it and contemplate it and consider. And I had no idea that the subject that I was going to talk about this year in 2020 would be so poignant for where we are right now. I picked it I usually pick it in the summer of the year before, and then I spend 6 months with it, and then start teaching it, and over the course of the year, kind of work with it. And then COVID-19 happened, and this kind of George Floyd happened, and all of a sudden the whole world just began to shift and change, and something happened. And this conversation on emotions became poignant because we're all experiencing a great deal of emotions. It's not even that you're Canadian and I'm in the States and you're like, well, that's the U.S. problem. It may have been that way at one point in time, but something about George Floyd's death kind of brought some kind of interconnected webbing to all of us all over the world. And the webbing that I think we got in touch with was emotional. Very, very deep kind of resonant emotions. And for practitioners, many practitioners I've talked to, it has thrown them for a loop because there was this expectation of what practice was supposed to be about and what it was supposed to do for me. And now I find myself crying or getting enraged at all these varying little things. You know, somebody could just not have a mask on. I don't know how it is in Canada, but here, I live in Seattle, so everybody kind of wears masks in Seattle. But, you know, I could go places in the suburbs and you can be around people that don't even seem to be caring about the COVID level of danger. It could be the same way there with you. Like, some people are very diligent and some people act like it's nothing. and we're subjected to all this emotional difficulty because we're sharing space with all this chaos and unknown. So what I want to talk about tonight is about emotions, what they are, because there are two types of emotions. You know, emotions, they're like the spice of our life. They put meaning in our lives. We need them. You know, they would make life life. Some kind of interconnection with life itself, with this very moment that we're having. So, but in Buddhism, there's a lot of talk in mindfulness or practice and Dhamma. It's about this non-self disenchantment, kind of this dispassion. And it can leave a lot of us or a lot of practitioners feeling like, oh, there should be no emotions. They should be dull, minimized, not very vibrant. So I begin to ask myself, what are these emotions? What is this emotional energy? You know, Buddha's followers were not considered dull and unemotional. They were actually considered and called the happy ones. Whenever they showed up, they carried with them a sense of happiness. It was upbeat, inspirational. I've been around a lot of monastics, and some monastics, it's true, their temperament is very even. But most of the monastics I know laugh a lot. I mean, they've given up pretty much everything, and yet they laugh a lot. So what is it about this understanding we have about emotions in practice and emotions, it's, you know, in our lives. This idea that if we're really going to have a joyous life, we should have some really good emotions going on. So I thought I'd take a step back and look at how information comes into us. Just a little bit of science here, because it kind of ties into what we think of, what we call emotions. We have data that comes in through our sense doors. And this data gets put into little categories by our mind. Mind keeps track of the data, and when new information comes in, it kind of tracks it and says, oh yes, you belong over there with that information, and this is in this category, and we kind of categorize and associate all of our information as it comes in, one at a time. All this new information that comes in gets evaluated. And it gets evaluated through habit and through our autopilot as to what it is. And I begin to check out some people, and I told some people recently that in a way we're like in a closed loop circuit. So as long as the information that's coming in fits in line with what we know to be true, it comes in freely. Come on in. You can come in. You can come in. You can come in. You can come in. Just welcome me. Sort of like the way Susan was. Oh, come on in. Hi, how are you? Come on in. You can come in. But if something comes to us that is not of our own natural associations and thinking, new information, different information, strange information. Our minds, the gatekeeper, will not let it in. It will stop it at the gate and it will not let it in. If for some reason it slides in and then begins to change, it will kick it out or put it in some kind of quarantine. So a way to begin to understand this is when you first begin to come into Dhamma, first begin to come into meditation, you're like, maybe you go to some weekend or you go to some evening sit back when we could meet together and we sat down and we practiced together. We're like, oh, I like this. I like this meditation. I'm going to do it. And next thing you know, you can't remember where your bench is. You can't even remember. I remember when I first started meditating, I had it all kind of like mind and eye. We worked it out. The information was just going to be the way my mind naturally was. And that's all it is. Just what I think. Just the way I agree. Everything is in line with what I agree. But then I started getting a little bit more into the body in this embodied way. And the practice began to move downward in me. And I started having problems with what I was hearing, what was happening. Things started shaking up a little bit. And I remember before I would sit every day religiously, 45 minutes, every day. It's like my happy place, happy time. But when I started getting more embodied, now I'm feeling some stuff, I'm remembering stuff, this kind of emotional stuff is coming up. And before long, I couldn't remember that I meditated. I would go to bed and I'd say, oh, I was going to meditate today. I forgot. I would just forget as if I never meditated before. It's the way the mind, when things start getting a little bit outside of what I want it to be, the mind starts coming up with all these little tricks. Dhamma, though, is an open-ended flow. It just flows. Information flows in and out. So this difference between the way Dhamma is and the way the mind associates information is one of the first links to seeing the difference between emotions as just part of the human condition and awakening emotions. The second little bit of information we got to have kind of like to prepare us for this conversation. One, we got to know that information that comes in is put through a filter. And that filter tries to control what all we know. The second thing is that it's the nature of how our kind of body operates. Little science here. The practical details of an event, of a moment in time, go into our hippocampus. And this energetic, more emotional aspect go to our amygdala. Now, if something happens to us that's a little too charged for us to deal with, that overwhelms our system, whatever it is, something like George Floyd, COVID-19, it comes in, it overwhelms, not quite sure. Too much. I don't know. I'm scared. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to deal with this. Something happens. When the details try to get logged into the hippocampus basically says, I'm paraphrasing what it says because it probably doesn't talk, but it boots it back out and says, nope, that's got too much emotion in it, too much energy. That doesn't belong here. tries to go over to the amygdala. Okay, maybe this is just emotional. Maybe I'm just feeling this. Try to put it in the amygdala part. Nope. Not. Nope. 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 It's not. It's too much detail. So this kind of battle between the aspects of our brain, the way it manages information and present moment experience, is why it seems so confusing to us, because we don't know where to put this information. We don't know what to do with it. And so a lot of information, when we're overwhelmed, gets just left on the cutting floor. It's just kind of free flowing through us, rambling in the mind. It doesn't have any structure to it. So we can be walking by a house and see something like a tree or a smell or a sound, and we are freaked out and don't know why, because it doesn't have any structure to it. It doesn't have any understanding. This is the basic way our emotions kind of come and go with us in this kind of human mind. So the more I read about emotions and tried to find the emotions in the suttas to figure out, well, what is the emotional part of practice? Because, I mean, you don't have to practice that long to realize we get pretty emotional. I mean, sometimes we can have a sit that's so peaceful, it'll bring you to tears. That's gotta be some emotion in there. Or sometimes you can just listen to a Dhamma talk on Dhamma Seed or listen to a Dhamma teacher and you're like full of joy. What is that? So I started looking in the suttas and I begin to understand something that I did not understand before. And in the suttas, when I think of emotions, they are capacity building experiences. What we call emotions are two different things. In the practice, it's capacity. And in our everyday, ordinary, common life, it is energy. It's two different kinds of experiences, and that's what I want to talk about. When I call these cultivating awakening moment emotions, what I'm talking about is this ability or this capacity that gets cultivated that allows the mind to awaken, that allows the mind to open to new information and not be trapped in the closed loop circle of everything has to fit within the way it's always fit and nothing else comes in. So instead, the mind gets open, fluid, like Kabir described. It's the sky is blue and farther, and love is on a level that we don't necessarily even see in our ordinary life. It's this capacity. It's an embodied experience that's unrelated to the thinking mind, and the gatekeeper is the heart and not this egoic mind of ours. So when I started looking, I found three sets of emotions that I want to talk about that add to this quality, that build capacity for our minds to be open and free-flowing. One set are the sets that are connected to metta in the Brahmaviharas. So if you don't know, that would be metta and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity. That's one set. We're going to talk about these qualities and the emotions themselves tomorrow, about how these qualities open up the mind's capacity for this free flow of information. Another way to think about it is, no one on this call can awaken in their ordinary state of mind, because the ordinary state of mind is limited to what you've already seen. And our ordinary minds would never allow any new information that is as far-reaching as an awakened mind could know. So in order for us to awaken, we need something that allows us to expand our capacities to be able to allow new information in. And metta is the quality that allows us to allow new information in. I'm not talking about the metta that we practice saying the phrases. We practice that metta so that we can cultivate metta within us. But I'm talking about the very fact that metta exists. It exists as an emotional capacity for us to allow new information in. That metta, that basic kindness, is one of the sets that we're going to talk about tomorrow. The second set that we're going to talk about tomorrow is a little bit different. I don't even know if you've ever heard of it, but it's a set called Samvega and Pasada. Samvega and Pasada. Samvega spelled S-A-M-V-E-G-A, Samvega, and Pasada, P-A-S-A-D-A. These are awkward emotions. That's why we got to talk about them and spend some time with them. Because when I tell you what they are, you're going to be like, what? This is awakening? I don't think so. Samvega is, let me see if I want to really say it now. I'm going to say it now because some of you may not be here tomorrow, but Samvega is this quality of absolute, there's no point in it anymore. That's it. No point going any further. It's a quality of complete disenchantment. And that disenchantment, the best I can help point to it is if you've ever known anyone or you yourself was ever addicted to alcohol or drugs and you went into recovery. You went into recovery when you reached a point that said, that's it. Can't go any further. I give up. I can't do it. This is killing me. I don't want to live this way anymore. And that energy right there is what gives you the capacity to turn towards recovery, to turn towards liberation. Samvega is that quality of just complete surrender, and you will not go this path any longer. Pasada, which is connected to Samvega, since you're not going on that path anymore, you need a new path. And so people who are in recovery will put their faith in the 12-step practice, their meetings. People will leave and come to the Dhamma and they'll put their faith in the path of the Dhamma. They leave their old way of moving and they put their faith in another one. So on the heels of this disenchantment, Posada is the faith in a path. It's not a faith in me any longer. It's a faith in the path. And you need those two anchors there. The emotional energy that's connected to, that's it. I'm not going any further down this path. And this sense of putting our faith in the path, that both of those emotional energies together, we cultivate them and we are moving towards awakening. We need that capacity in order to prepare ourselves or be mentally ready for new information. It's almost like you have to soften with the metta so that you can actually see a new way. Soften the eyes from the old way, and then you can begin to see a new way. And then the last set is another strange kind of coupling that we don't talk about often, but it is Hiri and Otapa. And Hiri, these are another set of difficult difficult energies or difficult definitions, but I'll share them with you just in case. But it is this kind of, Hiri is this like it's called moral shame, but it is this sense of this internal kind of guide that says, oh my God, I do not want to be seen doing some wrong. I do not want to be caught harming another being. That's probably the best way to explain it. We're going to get more into it tomorrow, but, and the Otapa, Hiri is H-I-R-I, and Otapa is O-T-T-A-P-A. This here, Otapa is this opposite, which is more of, I don't want to do any wrong. So one is an internal shame, and the other one is an external, I don't want to have wrongdoing. I don't want to be caught. Don't want to do any wrong. And the reason why these, it's a felt sense experience. We feel it as an emotion, this Hiri and Otapa, the same way we feel Samvega and Samvega and Posada, in the same way we feel the metta, the four Brahmaviharas. But what this Hiri and Otapa do is, they are these two, what the Buddha called guardians of the world. But if you think about it, when we have the quality of leaving the old way we've been and turning towards something new, we are moving into darkness. We won't be able to see and know what it is that we're doing. We won't know because it's all new. We won't have an idea of how to be. And Hiri and Otapa are like these two, it's like the night lights. I don't know if you guys have them very much, but we used to have lots of street lights outside, but now it's like you hardly go down the streets and there's no street lights. But it's like street lights. It's like these lights that kind of shine to tell us when we've gone too far this side or gone too far this side. This is this quality that we need, these nightlights, guardians, these mileposts, these posts, signs that tell us along the way whether we've gone too far or whether we have, whether we're on the path. That's how we know. That's how we get a sense Oh, I know what's going on. I know where I'm going. So one last thing. And then we're going to take some questions and we'll talk deeper about this tomorrow, about each one of those sets. This is what I come to understand about the distinction between awakening emotions and regular emotions. So regular emotions are conditioned on some outer condition. Something happens outside of us and triggers some emotion in us. We get trapped into that emotion so that in this way in which the emotion itself becomes the ground for our suffering. So we have some moment, something happens, we get disappointed, the emotion sucks us in, and now we are trapped in disappointment. And the mind begins to bring out all the times we've ever been disappointed, just to get the association good and nice and thick in there. So we get trapped in that disappointment and suffer more. We become caught in the suffering such that we have to make the outer conditions change so that we no longer feel that disappointment. Or we try to control our situations so we won't feel that disappointment in the first place. These emotions are regular emotions that come and go. They're impermanent, but they arise from our perception, our beliefs, and our habits. So if you're an averse type personality like I am, I have the habit of getting irritated if I don't like something. I can't help it. If I don't like it, I'm going to get irritated. What I have learned is to not express that irritation, but the emotional energy to get irritated is right there. On the greedy side, if you have that kind of personality, you're just going to want. Beautiful, beautiful. Got to be lovely. Got to be nice. Everything's got to look good. It's got to look great. Everything's got to be good. And that energy, we get trapped in that. So people, as soon as they, you know, they just want things to look nice, be nice, have a good thing. Everything's good. So that's what they're doing, trying to make everything nice, controlling everybody. But that's the way my mother was, you know. She was just always trying to make everything nice. Everybody's got to be happy. She was messing it up. We were all irritated and angry because she's really just trying to make it nice in her opinion. Oh my God, this time is going so quick. All right, so let me tell you a little bit about awakening emotions. There's a few more here, but I'll tell you this. It's connected, these regular emotions are connected to a sense of vulnerability and weakness. So when we feel all that emotional energy, we feel like vulnerable and weak. And most of us do not want to have any kind of emotional energies going on. We want to be even keel, like I don't even have emotions. And they are based in worldly concerns. Those four pairs of gain and loss and pleasure, pain, blame, praise, fame, and ill repute. All right. But the awakening emotions, they're different. They are not conditioned on outer situations, outer experiences. Disenchantment arises from practice. And we'll talk more deeply about it tomorrow, but it does not come from outer conditions. It comes from our practice. And it arises to support us and turning away from the sparkliness of ordinary stuff. When they're present, they have the potential of giving us good insight, great insight. So unlike regular emotions that we get trapped in the emotions, disenchantment doesn't trap us in misery. It has the ability to show us the potential of what's possible. That's how people who come to the edge of their addiction will turn and completely change their lives, because that disenchantment helps them let go and turn towards something new. They arise from our inner core. They don't arise from our perceptions or beliefs or associations. They come from an inner core within us, a knowingness that's more like our values, our ethics, our wisdom. And they are connected, associated with our inner strength, as opposed to this vulnerability and weakness. And they are unworldly, meaning that they are of a divine nature, a grace. They're non-self in and of themselves and universal, rather than this kind of worldly obsession that we can have. So the last thing I want to say is that we can see how these kind of work on the path. You could think of metta. So you know, on an Eightfold Path, there are three sections: ethical conduct, wisdom, ethical conduct, and our meditative qualities. So the wisdom aspect, right view and right intention, that would be samvega and pasada. This right view is turning towards this new understanding, a new possibility, turning towards insight. The metta is how we begin to connect to our ethical conduct. And then hiri and otapa is how we balance our samadhi and concentration, because we begin to learn how to steady ourselves on this path in the dark. The meditative qualities are our effort, our mindfulness, and our right concentration. And the ethical conduct that metta supports is this: the precepts, right conduct, right speech, and right livelihood. All of that grounded in metta. So this is what we're going to talk about tomorrow. I wish we had 2 days, but I figured out a kind of a way that we can kind of do this tomorrow.